I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up today, the United Nations hands power back to the East Timor police. Virgin Australia plans to go head-to-head with Australia's national carrier, Qantas. And the North Korean family in Australia fear persecution by North Korean secret agents based out of South Korea. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. A ceremony in Delhi marked the United Nations handing over full control of policing operations to the East Timorese National Police Force. The security crisis of 2006 showed the challenges that remain for police in East Timor. As a result, the United Nations police officers from more than 40 countries arrived to help with police duties and conduct training. Four of the five top contributing nations were from Asia: Malaysia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and the Philippines. Liam Cochrane speaks to Finn Risik-Nielsen, the head of the UN mission in East Timor.
In my assessment, in our assessment, the Timorese police is ready to stand on its own feet, on its own 2 feet. We have, of course, prepared for today's event, the signing of the an exchange of letters that certifies the full reconstitution of the police. We have done this as part of a longer process that started several months ago to carry out an evaluation of the readiness of the PNTL. That technical report concluded that the PNTL is indeed ready. It also says that there are some gaps in various areas and that continued capacity development would be required. But fundamentally, the PNTL is ready to carry out its policing functions across the country. And that's what I and the Prime Minister will certify later this morning.
Last week, the Prime Minister, Janana Gusmao, made some quite strong and pointed comments to the military, but also to the police, about the fact that commanders must take control for the management of their own resources and money, essentially. What are the gaps there that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I obviously cannot go into detail, but it is true that one of the areas to be covered in terms of further capacity development is indeed what you might call the back office operations, the support functions, budgeting, procurement, all those things will still need to be strengthened. But a lot of capacity development has been taking place over the past several years. In fact, since the UN police handed back responsibility for day-to-day policing 18 months ago, our main focus has been on capacity development. That is not a process that's completed as yet, and this is why we are counting on a number of bilaterals to pick up where the UN will leave off at the end of the year.
What plans are in place for those bilateral arrangements?
There is already a joint development plan that's been agreed between the UN and the government of Timor-Leste, and that has guided the support that the United Nations has been providing over the past 18 months. And the support into the future will be an extension of that plan. We have already several bilaterals in place, including Australia, which started its Timor-Leste Police Development Program several years ago. That program will continue. New Zealand has been involved in strengthening community policing over the past several years, and they have just started a new 4-year program. The United States is supporting the police, as is Portugal. So overall, I think we have a pretty strong set of actors there who can help cover those gaps in the coming years.
If there was to be another security incident like perhaps we saw in 2006 in East Timor, would those supporting countries through the bilateral operations be able to help back up the Timorese police force?
Well, first of all, these are, of course, capacity development activities. This is not a presence of foreign police forces. But secondly, I think it would be unlikely that there would be another incident like we saw in 2006.
How many police UN police officers will be heading out by the end of the year?
Well, at the moment, we have about 1,200 police, including our four so-called foreign police units, riot police. They will start being repatriated in the next few days, and we expect that by the end of November, the vast majority of UN police would have gone home. We will have maybe only a handful left in the month of December. They will be here to complete some of the ongoing training programs, and then they head out in mid-December.
That was Finn Riesek-Nielsen speaking to Liam Cochrane. In a major shakeup of Australia's aviation industry, Virgin Australia has taken a 60% stake in the Singapore Airlines-owned budget carrier Tiger Airways. The deal also gives Singapore a 10% stake in Virgin, securing a piece of Australia's lucrative domestic air travel market for the international carrier. It also presents a challenge to Qantas, which recently secured its own partnership with international carrier Emirates. Tracy Hutchinson spoke to Jeff Thomas, an aviation writer for the West Australian newspaper.
It does really reinforce the fact that Virgin is here well and truly to take on Qantas. It's rather interesting sort of evolution because Virgin Blue, as it was then known, started the low-cost revolution in Australia in a sustainable way, and that led to the demise of Ansett and all its regional subsidiaries. And now we find Virgin has morphed itself into a premium value carrier to take on Qantas head-to-head. At the same time, it has now taken over, if you like, Tiger, and it plans to grow it into a bigger low-cost airline, and also taken out SkyWest in Western Australia, and it's going to move, accelerate it into its regional subsidiary. Yes, you're going to end up with two very powerful airline blocks.
And what about the other player in the deal, Jeff Thomas? What's in it for Singapore Airlines?
Well, Singapore has long wanted a stake in Australia. I mean, if we go back into the early 1990s, it was a bidder for Qantas when it was privatised. British Airways, in fact, won out in that deal. It then tried to buy into Ansett, and Air New Zealand thwarted that. So it bought into Ansett via Air New Zealand in that ill-fated deal, which unfortunately led to the demise of Ansett, although Ansett was on the way out anyway. So it has long sought a position in the Australian market, in the domestic market. I mean, it's a huge player into many Australian capital cities and regional centres. Now it's a player in the domestic market in a significant way, which is something that it's been trying to do for 20 years.
Qantas has been struggling financially for some time, Jeff Thomas, although its deal with Emirates is expected to change that. Virgin, on the other hand, seems to go from strength to strength. Which airline do you believe will be more dominant in the future?
Look, I think it's actually going to end up being a 50-50. Qantas maintains it'll continue to have its 65% share of the market. It will be a slow process, but I see Virgin increasing its stake in the market over the next, say, 4 or 5 years, where it'll increase it up to 40-45% and possibly even to 50% in the longer term.
How would you describe this move today by Virgin? It feels fairly audacious. What's your view of it?
Well, that's what John Borghetti's all about. He used to run Qantas, and he knows this industry probably better than most. Very, very smart move. He's covered off all the bases very, very well, so it's good for the travelling public.
Members of a family of North Korean asylum seekers living in Australia say they fear the government in Pyongyang will punish their relatives back home if they're deported. The family is facing deportation to South Korea within 2 weeks, where they claim they're likely to be blackmailed by agents from the North. It's believed a total of 70 North Korean asylum seekers are currently facing deportation from Australia. John Stewart reports.
For Sung Park and her husband Dong Kim, it's been a long journey from North Korea to this apartment in the Sydney suburb of Redfern. The couple escaped to China with their son and later flew to Australia with fake passports in May last year. Mrs. Park says the experience left her son deeply traumatised.
When my son tried to cross over into China in search of me, he was caught by North Korean security forces and was tortured so cruelly, even though he was young. He told me that while he was confined in the cell, he thought, it's okay if he doesn't meet me, as long as he can die right now. He was beaten very badly.
Under Australian law, North Korean asylum seekers are considered to be dual citizens of both North and South Korea, and the family now faces deportation to South Korea within 14 days. The family's lawyer says that in South Korea, they face a life of poverty and continual surveillance from North Korean spies.
This family has had family members disappear from South Korea. There was one niece enticed to go back to China by probably North Korean spies and has not been heard from since. This family has made credible claims. This family is in danger, and it is the Australian government that is sending them back to danger.
Mr. Kim was injured in an industrial fire. Mrs. Park cares for him. Her son is in Villawood Detention Centre. Mrs. Park says that most of her family in North Korea are now living in prison camps. She fears that if she returns to South Korea, she will be pressured to return to North Korea.
North Korean escapees living in South Korea receive calls from North Korea promising to spare the lives of their relatives if they return to the North.
Mrs. Park's lawyer says that other countries accept North Korean refugees without using their dual citizenship with South Korea to deport them.
The United States very clearly takes them. Canada takes them. The United Kingdom takes them. These are not ratbag lefty states by any means. Australia is unique in its oppressiveness in this respect.
Mrs. Park and Mr. Kim hope the immigration minister will intervene on their behalf and allow them to stay in Australia.
And that was John Stewart reporting. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. The chief executive officer of the parties to the Nauru Agreement, or PNA Fisheries, Dr. Transform Akara, says he wants Pacific nations to look more at the value of their fish stocks rather than volume. He says they should move away from the idea that the more fishing licenses they give out to more foreign vessels, the more money they'll get. He added this will only bring down the fish prices and deplete fish stocks at a faster rate. Dr. Akura speaks next to Sam Seke.
No, we're not involved in the negotiations. That's really up to the countries. They themselves determine how they can best maximize the value of their day. So yeah, we don't have an involvement at all in that.
But they're using your system, the vessel day scheme.
We facilitate with the countries the setting of the days. Now these days are already set, so Solomon Islands knows exactly how many days it will have that it can sail in 2013, and then it goes. Each country goes away and negotiates. We don't have any influence or role to play at all in how countries decide to sell their days or their negotiations. That's purely a role that the countries play themselves. We provide the information, we provide the number of days they have, they can use whatever other information, but at the end of the day, each party would have to decide on its own how it maximizes the value of its day. So Solomon Islands has then gone ahead and negotiated with Korea and maybe sold some of its days. I'm sure it hasn't sold all its days to Korea because it has bilaterals with Japan, with Taiwan, and also for its own domestic. So it has to set aside days for its own, for its other fleet. What we know now is Solomon Islands has sold
some days to Korea, and I congratulate Solomon Islands for doing that.
So Solomon Islands can actually go, or any of the eight members of the parties to the Nauru Agreement can go ahead and negotiate with any of the countries with which they have bilateral fisheries agreements with for their vessel day schemes?
Exactly. That's what they do. They go away and then they negotiate the sale of their days.
And how do you determine how many days each member of the PNA countries should have?
That's set each year by the parties themselves. There's a formula that's used that's been developed. And each year the parties decide on the total allowable effort, and there's a formula that they use to determine how much each party has. So at the end of the day, or at the end of that process, they go away knowing exactly how many days they have, and that's what they use to negotiate.
Now, how much more beneficial or better is this system compared to whatever licensing system that was used before?
It's the same. You still license vessels. The only difference is that there's a limit in place, whereas before there were supposedly no limits in place. So, whereas now each country is obliged to comply with the limits that they have. So in other words, if you fish in your waters, you have to monitor the number of days that this fishing vessel spend. And once you reach that limit, you should ask those vessels to either stop fishing, or you then go ahead and you have to trade with other parties who have days. And that's why I made the point that this is business. And so there's a bit of forward planning that's required, and a bit of, skill set that's needed now is more business, economic planning, financial planning. You're managing the fishery through limits, but at the same time using an opportunity to maximize the benefits through limits. You see, the value of the resource is only enhanced through, you can enhance it through scarcity. So the less days you sell and the less opportunity, you can actually enhance the value that you get. So I'm just trying to get people to move away from this idea that the more licenses, more vessels there are, the more money that there, because it doesn't work that way. All you're doing is just depressing prices and overcapitalizing the fishery, and actually leading to depletion of the fish stocks. So my one message really that I've been trying to get to a lot of our government officials and leaders is that we should start looking away from quantity and now looking at quality, and we should be looking at value rather than the volume of fish that's being sold and exploited. In that way, we get better benefits than just simply bringing in so many vessels into the region, and as a result, we just depress prices. And at the end of the day, with depressed fish prices, we are the ones who suffer, because we're not getting the returns that we should be getting for our resource. And then our people suffer, because ultimately our governments are not able to raise revenue from the only one natural resource that we all share.
New regulations have been introduced in New Zealand. This is in the wake of a series of deadly accidents in the multi-billion dollar tourism industry. To find out more, Richard Erwart contacted Dominic Schwartz, the Radio Australia correspondent in New Zealand.
One of the aspects we were looking at was looking at what New Zealand is doing to try and tighten safety loopholes that it's had in the industry. Just to give you a bit of a picture, the adventure tourism industry is a very important one for New Zealand. Tourism generally is worth around about $18 billion Australian dollars a year to the country, and adventure tourism is a very big swag of that. There's about 2.5 million visitors to New Zealand each year, and about 40% of them will try at least one adventure activity. That could range anywhere from, you know, abseiling, bungee jumping, parachuting, to going on a mountain walk or riding the luges in Queenstown or Rotorua or anything like that. So it is a very big industry, and it's had quite a bit of bad publicity over recent years because there's been a string of high-profile fatalities. You'll probably recall the Fox Glacier plane crash in 2010. That actually happened on the day of the first Christchurch earthquake, so it was sort of subsumed then, but has made the headline quite a bit since. There were 9 people killed in that. And then in January this year, the Carterton balloon crash claimed 11 lives. And in between, there's been a string of other deaths. Now, around about 50 people have died over the last 8 years, according to the Prime Minister, John Key. He obviously says this is not good enough. He ordered a review into the industry. That's come back saying that it does need to be tightened up. All adventure operators need to be registered and certified, and they need to have their safety mechanisms and their systems checked externally. But interestingly enough, there are the bereaved families of some of the people who've been killed doing adventure tourism activities say, look, regulations is one thing, but what they're worried about is the culture of New Zealand. And I suppose that's one area where we were looking at. We were interested to see, well, what is the culture and what is it that they're saying that makes New Zealand a particularly unsafe place to be? And in looking at that, we looked at New Zealand's very unique system of accident compensation. Over here, if you're a visitor and you have an accident, you will be looked after at the cost of the New Zealand taxpayer. So anyone who has an accident will get looked after here, but the payoff is that you can't sue for damages. And Chris Coker, who is the father of one of the Fox Glacier plane crash victims who lives in Britain, he says that that system, the fact that you can't sue, means organisations aren't scared enough, they don't have enough incentive to really take health and safety as seriously as they should. And there's been some research conducted at Auckland University which suggests that may in fact be the case. And New Zealand's rate of workplace fatalities across industry is double that in Australia and quadruple that in the United Kingdom. And Professor Susan Watson, who's headed up this research at Auckland University, says it might be time for the government to consider bringing in a charge of corporate manslaughter, and if an organisation is found guilty, that they are open to being sued.
It would seem, I think, to large parts of the world, quite extraordinary that doesn't exist already. And the research that you refer to at Auckland University, I understand, is drawn a connection between the situation in the adventure tourism industry and with the Pike River mine disaster, for example, and the CTV building collapse during the Christchurch earthquake. There is a theme here.
Well, yes. If you look at workplace accidents, there has been quite a spotlight thrown on workplace safety in New Zealand over the last couple of years, because we had, as you rightly mentioned, the Pike River mine disaster. Now, the Pike Royal Commission has actually just yesterday handed its final report to the government, and we expect that the government will release that and its response to the Commission's findings early next week. So that will be very interesting reading, I'm sure. But even before we have that final report, we know there's been massive criticism of the way in which the mine was built, the way in which safety procedures weren't adhered to. So that's all come to light. And then, of course, with the earthquakes, there was the CTV building. 115 people died when it collapsed catastrophically in the February quake in 2011. And again, we've heard through the Earthquakes Royal Commission an absolute litany of failures there, from design to construction to oversight by the council. All the way along, it seems, there have been problems in terms of adhering to good health and safety. So the government is aware that health and safety in the workplace is a big issue, and it has in fact recently ordered an independent review of that. So it will be interesting to see, in the wake of these commission reports and everything that we've had so far, whether there will be any changes in the system. But I suppose one thing that should be noted, I mean, when you look at it in context of the accidents, people can say, well, why would they have this system? Well, when it was introduced back in 1974, there was actually a lot of people who were injured weren't getting any compensation, because, of course, it relied upon, if you were injured by somebody who had a lot of money that you could get access to, then you were compensated. But if you were injured by somebody who didn't have any money, well, then you didn't get any money for compensation. So what happened was the society decided, well, this is not good enough. We want to be able to support anybody who's injured, And that's why they brought in the system. So very sort of, you know, high values and a lot of good reasons for it. And it does work very well in a lot of instances, but it does seem to have this big hole. And whether or not they can introduce a hybrid system or do something different, we'll have to wait and see.
And finally, Papua New Guinea's politicians are calling for a ban on the sale and consumption of betel nut in major urban areas of the country. We now have this report from Firmin Nunau, who says this has been contributing to the country's diseases like tuberculosis.
For many Papua New Guinean families, betel nut brings direct cash income to their families and support many throughout the country. In fact, it's often referred to as the green gold, and you pay no tax on the sale and consumption of the green nut mixed with lime and mustard. The governor of PNG's capital city, Port Moresby, Poes Pakop, says betel nut chewing and spittle contributes towards the spread of communicable diseases like tuberculosis or TB and is unhygienic. He says major urban areas are littered with betel nut stains and rubbish and makes it a health hazard for many citizens. Governor Poes Pakop, who is fighting an uphill battle to stop the sale and consumption of betel nut in Port Moresby, wants it to be banned in the city.
TB is making a comeback in our city. Cancer is making a comeback in the city. And most of them is the airborne disease passed through chewing of betel nut and spitting out here and there. And if we start taking some of these measures, getting our people to practice good habits, good eating habits, good drinking habits, chewing habits, whatever, practice preventive health care, maybe they don't need to go to the hospital. They don't need to see a doctor.
The Minister for Environment and Conservation, John Pundari, supported Governor Pakop's call. He says betel nut chewing is an unhealthy habit and must be banned in the cities.
Got to be banned. Now, what is life compared to chewing betel nut and spitting betel nut in the city of Port Moresby? Is life worth more than chewing betel nut and spitting betel nut in the city of Port Moresby? Or is this information we are reading in the newspapers about this drug-resistant TB? You know, I'm just concerned. If it hits the city of Port Moresby and the way we chew betel nut and the attitude of our population in the city that carelessly spits betel nut all over, how will we contain this disease everywhere around the country? We've got to legislate and force that legislation, ban betel nut chewing.
They were debating on a statement presented by PNC's Health Minister Michael Malabag. The minister said lifestyle diseases is on the rise and urged people to take care of their personal health. Mr. Malabag told Parliament the drug procurement and supply systems must be improved to ensure drugs reach rural health facilities. PNG's opposition leader, Belden Nama, says health is an individual thing. He says people should take care of their personal hygiene to prevent getting sick rather than going to the doctor when they are sick.
We have to educate our people on the way they live, our attitudes. Papua New Guinea's problem is attitude problem. You go to some of the hospitals where it's an hospital bed, but it's already broken bed. There's betel nut stains on the wall everywhere. You go to Port Moresby General Hospital. Papua New Guinea needs a serious attitude change. And how do we do it? To live a healthy life is something that one must do himself or herself. Prevention is better than cure.
The governor of PNG's Oro Province, Gary Jufa, says the country should adopt a strict national population control policy. He says PNG's got a high population growth rate and it must be controlled to meet the health and educational needs of its people.
Our population growth is placing a huge burden on the existing infrastructure. In addition to that, we have limited resources, and yet we have not made an effort to develop a plan to check the population growth of our country. The entire world is suffering from a population growth problem, and we will start facing those problems in Papua New Guinea. And such other issues are all related to a population boom. So I would like to suggest that an effort be made to develop a policy to check our population. And such an effort should include the development of curriculum so that it can be taught at our educational institutions, and that our children can be taught about the importance of basic hygiene, nutrition, fitness, and even population growth.
Many international donor organizations, including the World Health Organization, have said PNG needs to improve on its basic health indicators. Femen Nanok, Port Moresby.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.